Hello, welcome to the Long Shot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Dr. Alan Leica. Dr. Leica suffered a near-death experience and sought renewal through the wisdom of human virtues that refocused him on life of richness, appreciation, joy, and service. He is now a full-time service, life-changing speaker, acclaimed author, and transformational leader. Great story, long shot story. Think you're going to like it. Here is Dr. Alan Leica.
All right, I'm here with Dr. Alan Leica, and he's got a heck of a long shot story we're going to get into later, but we do the beginning. We want to find out the algorithm of him. He's got some value with his story. So let's go back to the beginning. Were you born and raised in Canada? Because I know you're in Edmonton. We talked about in the pregame. Where were you born, bud?
Grew up in Calgary, the home of the world famous Calgary Stampede. And I moved up to Edmonton for medical school. And then I trained at the University of Minnesota in dermatology. So I trained on both sides of the border. Then I came back home to practice in Edmonton.
Why would dermatology? What led you to that?
You know, it's funny. You know, when you go through medical school, the first thing you find out what you don't like. One day on Christmas Eve, one year, it was so cold that 24 babies got delivered and I had to catch all of them. So I knew I wasn't going to be an obstetrician. That was something else I didn't like. You know, being in a formal operating room was something I didn't like. The stuff you see on TV and stuff like that, I hated that. That was something I just, and you know, being in intensive care and emergency rooms where you're awake all night, taking care of gunshot wounds and stuff like that. Please, that's not my existence. So, you know, I did a rotation in a dermatologist's office, and I said, wow, this is the most amazing thing since sliced bread. I said, I'm going to be a dermatologist. Then it was hard to get in because, you know, there are only a handful of spots for the people that, and hundreds of people applying. So I got in by sheer tenacity and hard work and everything else. And I was able to get a position at the University of Minnesota, and I stayed there for 3 years.
Now, were you a good student? Because, you know, to get in the medical field, you got to be a pretty good student. What was that like?
Yeah, the problem is everybody's a good student that's a medical student. You know, everybody's in the top 1% of people that are in university. So it's tough because how do you choose between all top 1%ers?
I mean, in high school, were you a good student?
You know, not really. I went to a school called Bishop Carroll, which was a school where you didn't have to attend school to get your work done. They invented something called a free school where everything was done by unit packs. So you'd go into social sciences and they say, you have to complete these 30 unit packs to get done. Now, I was a bright student, so I did the bare minimum to get done. They always had, these are the 5 objectives you will learn from this unit. Well, I had them done already.
What about mom and dad? What do they look like? What do they do for a living?
You know, my father was a gardener. My mother was a homemaker. You know, my father emigrated from Czechoslovakia. My mother's family came from the Ukraine, you know, at the turn of the century. So very simple people that didn't do it. They always told me I'm not going to work as hard as them. So they said, you do whatever you want, but you're not going to work like we did.
Yeah, my grandmother escaped from the Ukraine when the turn of the century. They were, you know, Jewish. So, you know, why'd you guys get out? Were you Jewish and had to escape the Russian concentration camps? What was your story there?
Well, the Ukraine was poor back then, so they escaped to a better life in North America. There was free land in Canada, so they became homesteaders. And so Canada didn't have slavery, but we had people that were willing to be slaves to the land to have a better living.
Right. Awesome. Okay, so you go to medical school. Now, that this is the more glamorous of the dermatology, you know, when you graduate, do you work for another company? You set out and start your own little company, you know, how does that look?
You know, you can do anything you want. You can work for a university and be an academic. You can go and set up your own business. You can work for a big company. I set up with 2 other dermatologists back in Edmonton. And, you know, we had a very flourishing practice where we'd see 70 to 100 patients a day each. It was a very, very busy time. But back in the early 1990s, cosmetic dermatology was invented, where, you know, Botox and things called fillers and lasers were invented. And I was really intrigued. So I learned all those skills. And so I flipped over to doing part of my practice that way. I also was a skin cancer surgeon. There was a type of surgery called Mohs micrographic surgery, where you take off cancers layer by layer by layer until they're done. So those were my main fortes, skin cancer and cosmetic surgery.
You get out of college, you start working at a dermatologist, you know, I'm from LA, you know, and you know, Beverly Hills. And I, from what I know, there's a lot of attractive women. Did you meet a lot of, you know, pretty people and, you know, in your business and, you know, what was that like? I have to ask that question because it's part of the job.
The answer is you do. And your job then is to try and help them stay attractive. Your job is to try and make them so. You know, this funny thing called Botox is a fascinating story because it was invented by one of my colleagues in Vancouver, Canada. You know, his wife was an ophthalmologist. And one day the husband walked in and said, "Why do you like Botox so much?" And they said, "It makes my wrinkles go away." So then it became the mainstay for treating wrinkles. You know, this little part in between your eyes here is a part that makes you frown and it makes you look mad and mean. So if you put Botox in that area, it enlarges that area by a few millimeters and it makes you look serene. It makes you look calm. And studies have shown you're more attractive that way.
You know, not to go off the deep end this, but, you know, I'm stand-up comedian, you know, and I take pride in mugging. They call mugging where, because you have so many, you have more muscles in your face than you do the rest of your body, I believe, or some, you know, paraphrasing. But in order to, you take away some of those contortions or those slightly, you know, 1 degree nuances, you can't have an expression that you might normally have at your fingertips. Don't people lose a little bit of that when they get Botox?
Well, they do, but you know, it really... What I always tried to do was use called Botox Light. So not to the point that it takes away all expressions, but it minimizes the expressions that were there. So it didn't totally take away all the you didn't have a frozen face or things like that. I always found it better to do it at a light level so that people would still have expressions, but not to the point that it was making them look mad and mean.
Right. Okay. So you're working for another firm, and tell us about because we know you get into something that's challenging in life, but there's a lot of, you know, milestones in between that. Kind of tell us about your journey between, you know, your career that's, you know, starting to launch and that incident.
You know, it was amazing. When I started working back in Edmonton in 1989, you know, it took off. But, you know, the first couple of months were quiet. And my partners would say, good, enjoy it, because it's not going to be quiet for long. And certainly within 6 months, it really just blossomed and took off. And then I started using all those other techniques that were available, and it just took off like crazy because everybody wanted those techniques. And I was one of the few people that was using all those techniques. So it literally blossomed. Now everybody's doing it. But back then I was one of the pioneers.
Right. Yeah. And then tell us, you know, what does that, you know, do to your career, and what does it take you from there? Where do you go from there?
Well, you know, back then, I really didn't understand the business of cosmetic surgery, so I had to learn it. So I was trained by a person by the name of Dan Kennedy, who taught a lot of people how to do business. He taught me how to do things like attract customers, how to keep customers. He taught me how to do things. You know, one of the number one things I used to advertise on was soap operas, you know, because soaps were people that the people wanted these cosmetic procedures. And so I learned to put little television ads on it, and it became my mainstay for a number of years. Secondly, I learned that word of mouth marketing was the most important thing. So I do seminars in my office where people would come and they'd learn about these procedures and they'd just love them. So we had a lot of these start of doing seminars. No one was doing them back then.
were you still working with this other company, or did you take off on your own practice?
You know, after about 4 or 5 years, I went on my own because I was doing so much in this cosmetic arena. It just wasn't in keeping with the things that they were doing. So I decided that was better for all of us if I moved on my own. And then I had a staff of 30 to 40 people to help me do everything because there was so much. There was just so much to do. So I had nurses and nurse helpers to do all the procedures that I was doing.
So this is big, you know. So this is like, you know, you're working for a firm, you get out of college, okay, and then you make some marks on your own, and then you branch on your own, and then you got a big, you know, company that you're heading. That's a big, you know, milestone. That's something that, you know, people, you know, what would you attribute to really, you know, was it just the innovation? You know, that crossroads is big, you know, maybe monetarily as well, and plus your passion in your career.
Well, you become the marquee in the area. You become the head dog in the area. You become the go-to doctor. You become the guy that everybody wants. In fact, I was so popular, people couldn't, you know, I couldn't go anywhere without people knowing me and hearing of me. It was like a Hollywood movie star, you know, but I was a local star because of the things I do. I'd often be covered on the 6 o'clock news for my expertise and things like that. So I was the go-to guy back then.
You know, you seem like you're pretty modest. Did you ever get to a point, you know, you're young and you have, it seems like success came fast. You know, once again, finance is probably a paradigm shift there. You know, did you start to think, you know, hey, look, you know, get a little, you know, not totally cocky, but, you know, did you have that moment where like you had to give yourself an adjustment, you know?
I always tried to be modest. I always tried to be the person, you know, although people thought I was God, I never played that role of God. You know, there's a bad joke about the plastic surgeon who goes to heaven and he looks at God in his chair and he says, God, what are you doing in my chair?
Oh, that's great. So yeah.
So I never tried to be that God.
Now, did you ever, you know, practice on yourself?
No, it's, you know, in Canada, it's not allowed to do those things. You're not allowed to do things on yourself or your family. Huh. It's really not the right thing to do. You know, you learn your things by going to courses in the States and different places, and you learn your stuff by doing it in other areas.
You know, plastic surgery and cosmetics, you seem like you've seen it all. So I want to know, along this journey, I want to get to, you know, where you go next. But what are some really strange things when, you know, that you occurred, that experience, whether it was like a patient wanting something or you just, it'd be silly for me not to ask that question. You know, I want to hear something, you know, sensationalistic.
The strongest word you can learn as a cosmetic surgeon is no, that this procedure is not right for you. Yeah. That really, you're a beautiful person. And if I did this to you, it would be a disservice. You know, I had a girl come in once that literally wanted all these cosmetic procedures. And I said, no. And she said, well, what can you do for me? And I said, if you really want help, you need to see a psychiatrist. And so, you know, her father was so overjoyed with what I said that, you know, they became lifelong patients for me because really this girl was going off the deep end. She had delusions and hallucinations about the things she wanted to get done. So I said no, which was absolutely the right thing to do.
Yeah. And she was a lifelong patient. She went to you for facials or something afterwards or something like that.
Well, she came in for just other things, you know, and I was glad to do them. But the important thing is, you know, a good cosmetic doctor does not do cosmetic surgery because the patient wants it. They do it because it's the right thing for them.
Right. Okay. So business is thriving. You've established it. You know, you've got your own lane. You're doing extremely well. You're the king in your arena in that area. Where does your journey take you from there?
You know, it was interesting. Back in the early 1990s, about 1993, I was walking with my wife at Disneyland, and my wife said, what's wrong with you, hon? And, you know, I was taken aback, Michael. For once in my life, I hadn't said anything wrong. I hadn't done anything wrong. I hadn't even thunk anything wrong. I said, what do you mean, hon? She said, listen to your foot. I said, dear, that's the funniest thing you ever said. Well, she said, no, it's not. Listen to it. And my right foot had suddenly and mysteriously developed a right foot drop. It was flapping on the pavement with each step I was taking. She said, what's wrong with you? I said, dear, I have no idea. She said, did you have a stroke? I said, dear, you're a doctor. I'm a doctor. If I had a stroke, I'd probably be lying on the pavement right now, muttering something unintelligible. So she then said, when you get back, you better get this checked out. Well, Michael, what do you do when your wife gives you that ultimatum?
I'm kind of stubborn. I might like put it off, but you should go and say, and, you know, yeah, you got that warning sign. You should go check it out.
Yeah. And really most men would say, yeah, you got to get it checked out. So they listen to their wives because if they don't, they know what's coming.
Yeah.
So I saw dozens of doctors, probably hundreds of doctors by the end, because doctors refer to other doctors who refer to other doctors. They did CAT scans. They did brain scans. They even did scan scans. And you know what they showed at the end of the day?
What?
Absolutely nothing. They were flabbergasted. They didn't know what to do. And you know what a doctor does when he sees nothing?
What?
More tests and more tests and more tests. I think they even invented tests just to do tests back then.
So, well, you know, and your foot was flapping on the ground. Did your foot feel like pins and needles and tingling, the muscle reaction was just kind of a flapping?
I lifted up the foot when I was walking. And, you know, if I wasn't paying attention, I would have fallen flat on my face. You know, your brain is programmed to lift up your foot with each step you take.
Yeah.
But somehow mine wasn't working that way.
Wow.
Now, the common causes for that are a brain tumor or a slipped disc or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, but mine just came out of the blue.
What happened? What happens next?
Well, you know, all these doctors then got together and they said, we have a solution. We're going to send you to a world-leading neurologist. A neurologist is the brain guy. He's the guy that has all the answers to these complex questions. So they sent me there and I walked in and I said, hi. He said, hi back. You better be sitting down when I tell you this. I said, what's going on? He said, you have ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. You better get your affairs in order. You have 6 months to live. Now, I was taken aback. I mean, I had a dropped right foot. And I told him, no, I don't. I have a dropped right foot. Is there a way to prove this diagnosis? And he said, of course, an autopsy.
Oh, my God.
Well, that's when I got mad. I ran out, slammed the door, and I said, I'm not going to die to prove you wrong. You know, and so, Mike, when you go through this, you go through the phases of death and dying that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote in her book on death and dying. You go through anger. You know, you've just been hit in the face, so you're angry as hell. Yeah. You're angry at the world. I was angry at my wife. I was angry at my patients. I was angry at my staff. They knew something was wrong, but I couldn't share it with them. Otherwise, they might abandon me. Yeah. Second thing, you go through bargaining. You know, the phase of, oh God, please don't let this happen. I will do anything if you don't let this happen. But I thought God wasn't listening back then. You know, you go through denial. Oh, there's nothing wrong. I just have a little problem. But you know, I had a dropped right foot. And then my right hand started not working right. You know, I was right-handed. And, you know, I couldn't hold the surgical instruments and the lasers like I used to. But I was smart. I had a left hand and I adapted to becoming left-handed. And I was able to do all my surgeries with my left hand that my right hand did.
Yeah.
Then you go through the last phase, which is depression. Have you ever been depressed, Michael?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's bad, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. That's when you stare in bed all day, staring at the ceiling and say, why should I go on? I'm going to be dead anyhow. You know, you have no purpose. You have no reason for living. You can't eat. You can't sleep. It's just bad. I even had a plan to kill myself then, because I wasn't going to die like ALS people do, gasping for air and not even being able to breathe. But before that, I went to my wife and said, "Dear, what do I have?" And she said, "I have no idea, but you're smart. You'll figure it out." I said, "Dear, I've seen hundreds of doctors. How can I figure it out?" She said, "Perhaps you haven't seen the right doctor yet." Well, back then, something new was invented. It was the internet. You ever hear of that thing?
Yeah, we're using it right now, brother.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, it's funny how in 20 years it's taken over the planet. But back then, it was so primitive. You had to get on by dial-on connections. Your phone would communicate with another phone on the other end. It would go for something like 15 minutes. And if you're connected, you could get to the other side. Now, computers had no memory back then. You didn't have Dr. Google. You didn't have Dr. Yahoo to help you. All you could do was use a basic language called DOS and go through and check each site. And it was really, really, really hard. Now, I had friends that were nerds, and so they helped me along the way. So they helped me find a doctor in Colorado Springs, Colorado, by the name of David Martz. David had a story very similar to mine, but he got worse much more rapidly. And within 6 weeks, he was on his deathbed. Now, David was interesting. He was so loved by everybody that people were coming up to say goodbye to him. And a Dr. Harvey came up from Texas, and he looked at David and said, "David, I don't think you have ALS. I don't think you have Lou Gehrig's disease." David whispered, because that's all he could do, "What do I have?" The doctor said, "I think you have chronic Lyme's disease. I think you've been bitten by a tick, and it's mimicking ALS. You can't tell the difference just by looking at it." Well, David said, "Well, what do I do?" The doctor from Texas said, "You need not do anything. You just need to start on this treatment. And if I'm right, you'll get rapidly better." Well, a miracle happened. And within 3 weeks, he was like Lazarus arising from the dead. He was totally back to normal. Okay. So I knew I had to get in touch with this person. So I looked everywhere, and I knew he was in Colorado Springs, Colorado. I knew he was a doctor. So I phoned every hospital in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and I got in touch with him at the Methodist Hospital. And then we talked for hours, and he said, "Dr. Leica, can you come down to see me?" I said, "When?" He said, "Right now." I said, "David, this is Thanksgiving in Canada. My wife's invited 50 people over. She'll kill me." He said, "Aren't there any planes in Canada?" So, Michael, I went down. I flew from Edmonton to Denver, and then from Denver to Colorado Springs. Now, the full plane from Denver to Colorado Springs was a rinky-dink puddle jumper. Have you ever been on one of those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in Fiji, we almost crashed.
Yeah, that's the problem with them. They're terrible. Yeah. And the plane that I was on was at the end of the day, and the wind comes off the deserts, which creates turbulence. So the plane will be flying along, and it'll drop 100 feet without a warning. And then it'll climb back, and then it'll drop 200 feet without warning. It'll climb back, it'll drop again, and climb and drop 300 feet without. So it was like the drop of doom at Disney World over and over and over again. So when I got off, I crawled off, and it was green. And there was David on the tarmac to meet me. He was a well-known doctor. I was a well-known doctor. So he was able to do that. And we talked for hours. And he said some magic words. "History is repeating itself. I'm going to start you on treatment." And he did. And that's why I'm still here in now what's going to be 2023 and thriving.
What does that treatment look like?
You know, it consists of several things. I get a treatment called IVIG, which is called IVIG is a type of gamma globulin that suppresses your immune system, which is attacking the nerves that you have. So it literally helps it to do well. I also am in a type of pill that helps me as well. Now, if anybody's listening and has Lyme's disease, I do not want you just to jump on this. I want you to see a doctor that's Lyme aware and get treatment from them. I don't treat people. I don't give advice for that. I'm just talking about my journey.
You know, people that don't live in the city, people that live in the city don't really worry about this as much. But, you know, when you live in the country, how can you prevent, you know, getting bit by a tick and having that tick in? How do you prevent this happening? It's such a crazy little thing.
Well, the thing is, be aware. And, you know, anytime you go out, check your whole body. If you have a tick, take it out. Start on antibiotics early because they are really a godsend. Make sure you see your doctor right away, because really the early treatment for Lyme's disease prevents it becoming the chronic disease.
Ah, now how do you take it out properly? You hear all these stories.
Well, you know, you should Google it, because yeah, there's a lot of good advice.
I want to hear from you. You're the guy. People are listening.
The answer is you could heat up a match and put it next to it, or you could take a pair of tweezers and gently pull it out. It's important to do it properly.
Okay. All right. We won't have to get into detail. This is not like a bullet point, you know, a study on how to get rid of a tick. You know, we're jumping off the deep end there. But so you kick this thing in the ass. Now, does it get rid of, you know, the flop and the symptoms? And what does that recovery look like?
Unfortunately, the damage to the nerves was done there. So I still have a right foot that doesn't work properly. Mm-hmm. So I have a brace on my right foot. So that I don't fall flat on my face when I'm walking. Mm. And I have a right hand that doesn't want to do a lot. It can't do all the things it used to do. But the good news is I have a strong left hand and a strong left foot, and I'm able to do all the things that are important.
So you trained yourself to become ambidextrous in order to still perform as a surgeon, as a dermatology and everything else.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. How long did it take you to do that, to where you really felt comfortable to like operate? You know,
they say 10,000 repetitions is what makes an expert. So you just have to do things over and over and over again. You know, most doctors that are surgeons are pretty already ambidextrous. They can do things with their left hand and their right hand. It's just getting better at doing the left hand than you used to be.
So what does your life look like today? What are you doing today now that you have learned all this and done what you've done?
You know, because of these things that I went through, I met an amazing lady by the name of Harriet Tinka, and we wrote a book together called The Secrets to Living a Fantastic Life. You know, Harriet's story was similar to mine, but different. She was a world-leading model who had walked the cat ropes of New York and Milan and stuff like that. And she grew tired of it because modeling is a dog-eat-dog industry. So she decided to become an accountant, which was her second love. So she went to the University of Calgary in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And there she was befriended by a person who turned out to be a psychopath, who ended up kidnapping her, stabbing her, and leaving her for dead. Now, somehow she got to the hospital. She was resuscitated, and she was going through rehab, and she was so depressed. She met a young girl by the name of Amber who asked her story. And Harriet told her story. And Amber, who had been in a car accident where she had lost both of her parents and use of her legs, looked at Harriet and said, "You should be ashamed of yourself because you're 100%. You should use your story to empower other people." So our journeys crossed because, you know, when I came through this journey, I decided to give back to society. And I sponsored an event for the YWCA called Women of Distinction, where I'd give awards to the top women in the Edmonton area. And Harriet applied for an award called the Turning Point Award. Now, she applied for it not to win the award, but to meet me and convince me to write a book. And that was the book we wrote called The Secrets to Living a Fantastic Life. When we released it in 2020, it became a bestseller. And then this little thing called the pandemic came around.
Right.
And I was going to go around the world speaking, talking about these things. But, you know, there wasn't any stages to speak on. Everything had dried up. So I invented a podcast called the How to Live a Fantastic Life podcast, which became a syndicated radio show. And it now has 4 million listeners a month. Now, Michael, that's a short journey to success. I mean, it was only 2020, and I probably started the syndicated radio show a year later. So it didn't take long to get that big following.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, what's the long term? You're still young, you know, you're doing really well. You know, do you have any long term goals or things that you're working on?
Well, you know, it's going to be an exciting year. I'm starting a new community called fantasticliving.ca, where people can get some of my best stuff. I'm starting another community on the internet called burningembersgroup.com for nurses and doctors that are burnt out. I'm starting a new podcast syndicated show called Doc Fix That, where I and a partner fix businesses that are broken. And we hope that to get picked up by Sirius Radio and get syndicated and out there. So Sirius, if you're listening, pay attention, because this is on the books for the early 2023. And you know, that it's a wonderful life, Michael. It's so beautiful. You know, it's not what happens to you. It's what you do with what happens.
You know, that's a good podcast for my doc. How do I fix that? Hey, how do I fix these ball sacks under my eyes? I'm getting older. I got these dull. Is the only thing the eye surgery? How can I get rid of these bags under my eyes, doc?
You know, there's a lot of different ways. You know, under this lighting, I can't really tell what they are.
Yeah, it's because I'm using the ring lights like everybody else does. I'm telling you, I got these old Jewish bags under my eyes. I'm starting to look like Don Rickles, and I don't want to look like that.
Well, you know,
what do I do, Doc? What do I do?
You got to see somebody, Michael. You know, there's no quick fix. You got to see somebody, and if they're good, they'll explain 3 or 4 different options for you, and you'll choose.
Yeah, then I feel vain. Then I go neurotic about it. Yeah, it's a battle.
You know, that's your Jewishness coming out, Michael. You know, to make progress, you got to take a step forward. And if you don't like something, you don't have to live with it. The question is how much you don't like it.
Yeah. All right. Hey, you know what? It's a cliche, but you are living a fantastic life. You know, I love I love what you overcame. That's why I do the show, and you're the epitome of that arc of the story we try to tell. So thank you so much for sharing it today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. And if anybody would like some more, check out my website, dralenleica.com. That's D-R-A-L-L-E-N, Leica, L-Y-C-K-A.com, because there's a lot of resources there. And sign up for a golden pearl that I give you each and every week on Tuesday, because that golden pearl will change your life if you let it. And there's going to be all these exciting things up in 2023. And by signing up, I'll keep you abreast of all these amazing things.
Dr. Alan Leica, thank you so much for sharing today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me on your show. I can't tell you how much I look forward to this.
Likewise. Thank you.
That was Dr. Alan Leica. Got the perfect quote for you, Doc. Here it goes. I love to win, but I love to lose almost as much. I love the thrill of victory, and I also love the challenge of defeat. Lou Gehrig, thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hanging with you all on the next episode. All right, have you guys been to longshotleaders.com? That's where you can check out all of the guests and the bios and the backgrounds and more. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we do, give us a good rating. Tell your family and friends to come by and listen. It's going to make you feel nice and toasty inside. Every week, we'll be delivering knowledge, creativity, inspiration, exasperation, perspiration. If it ends with a shun, basically, you're going to find it here. All right, thank you for joining us. And in the great words of Bill Murray in the movie Caddyshack, friends for life, I say.